This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name's Fraser Spears, and again for this deployment series, I'm joined by Bradley Chambers, and we'll talk to you about our sponsors as the show goes on. Bradley, how are you doing?
Fantastic. We are, as we record this show, we are preparing for Grandparents' Day at our school, and it's really a fun day, but it's also a very stressful day because you'll have a lot of people on your campus. And so usually I'm involved with some sort of technical-based job, like running the keynote for the actual program or something like that. And this year I have been promoted to driver of the four-row golf cart.
Sure, that would probably be the best day of the school year for me. I could just drive a golf cart all day.
Well, the best part is there's another parent who is a friend of mine also driving the golf cart. And so we are already planning on how are we going to – because we have responsibilities early in the morning. So we have a breakfast that's on a building across the way from our campus. And so we have to shuttle our grandparents back and, you know, from breakfast to the program. Then we have about a two-hour break where we have nothing to do. And we have a full battery on these golf carts.
So off-road course.
Yes, absolutely. And our campus has – the neighborhood it's in has some hills. So we shall see what we will do.
Okay. You bring them back splattered in mud, and people will be asking some questions.
So, yeah, good time. How are things in your neck of the woods?
Oh, not bad. You know, at this time of year for secondary teacher, you've kind of done all your teaching, and it's now just like paperwork and panic stations all the way to the exam. Most of my exam classes are kind of done with the teaching part, and we're mostly just sort of sitting doing exam papers every day as part of the kind of practice that you do up into the exam. So it's a lot of printing out and it's a lot of marking, but it's not a lot of direct teaching of new things anymore. So sometimes when I'm doing all the teaching, I think, oh, it's going to be great when we get to the exam paper bit, and then you get to exam paper bit and you're like, oh, I wish I had this teaching. I didn't have to do so much marking anymore. So it's a wee bit of both, but, the end is in sight, at least for me, if not for the kids quite yet.
Yes, we're in that boat too. We're a couple of weeks away from spring break. And then once we come back from spring break, it goes so fast. And then we begin prepping for the next school year. And there's a lot of database work that I have to do as school ends, with report cards, with actually promoting students, getting transcripts sent off. And so summer is fun, but it's busy. And it goes by oh so quickly, because typically, I'll be off a week or two during that time. My boss will be off a week or two during that time. So it makes kind of planning and making financial decisions a little trickier. But again, that's, you know, I often think that we're so lucky because we'll sit there and say, oh, I've got so much to do during the summer, but there's nobody around. And so it's much easier to do it. And I think about our friends in the corporate world, and there are no summer breaks. When they want to do big network changes, they have to do them on the fly. It's because there's no shutting down.
Yeah, no, those gigantic maintenance windows that we get every year are very, very handy.
Yes.
Are you planning big changes in the summer?
Depending on how the finances work, we'll do some switching and some. I think our firewall and switch changeover is probably going to happen in the summer. As we get closer to summer, I think I'll have the money available probably 1st of May. But at that point, you might as well wait just to June and let school be out.
Yeah. We don't have anything big planned for this summer, I don't think. I suppose we might change over to managed distribution if we get all the bits and pieces in place in time. Obviously not device enrollment, because that's still not – I don't think that's going to be in the UK in time for us to enroll all our devices. But device enrollment and managed distribution and MDM are two different things, and I believe we do have managed distribution capabilities. So that's something we might think about doing, but – I'm not exactly sure how that transition is going to work just yet.
Well, and then you've got you're like us, you're in the middle of a deployment. And so how much do you change at the beginning, or how much do you just wait and say, okay, we're going to wait until our next go around, let all the bugs get worked out, because what do you gain in the middle of it is your challenge. Of course, for you guys, I'm sure you're just hoping to have device enrollment in your country by your next deployment 2 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. The device enrollment for us right now is not a big deal, because obviously we've enrolled all our devices, we've got it all set up, and sure, the belt and braces stuff would be nice, but that'll be a much more interesting thing for us to have in 2016. The only thing that would prompt me to try and move quickly towards managed distribution is to get away from giving away software to students. Because at the moment, obviously, we're uploading coupon codes into our MDM and distributing them to the kids, and then we never get them back. But we've done that for now. You know, we've given away a lot of software to kids, and we're not going to get that back. So the question is, how much more are we going to give away over the next 2 years that would make it worth aggressively moving? And of course, there'll be two classes moving into that deployment model over the next 2 years. But they're not massive classes, so you know, maybe we could just take it on the chin and pay for that software set for those two classes. And then once we get our new devices, it's a whole new deployment again in 2016. But it depends on how easy or hard the transition is. You know, I guess it's just a wee bit of a management job for the next couple of years.
And the thing is, 2016 will really be here before you know it. Because you'll realistically start thinking about it hard in probably about another year and starting to think about your plans. And, you know, it's almost, you know, we finish our budget and then we start the budget year in August. And by October, we're already working on next year's budget. So, you know, there's so much that goes into anything that we do that you think you've got time to kind of sit on your laurels, but then it's go time again.
Yeah, this might be the last quiet summer for a while. Eventually, I'll get my Apple TVs enrolled in MDM as well.
And maybe I'm really hoping by next school year that iOS 7.1 is out. Really, really hoping.
Well, I don't know. You're asking for a lot there.
Yeah, I hear so many. I've heard so many complaints. Really, in the past 2 or 3 weeks, like, gosh, AirPlay is just not as good as I thought it was. And it's like, well, it's terrible. And then I feel like that. Yeah. I'm kind of like the boy who cried wolf. It's like, hey, just wait for 7.1. Like, just hang on until 7.1, and all your problems will be solved, and then hopefully they will be. For example, my headmaster is on Mavericks, and we just have had nothing but trouble with Apple Mail. So as of today, he's running AirMail on the Mac, and then actually Mailbox on iOS, and he's liking it so far. And he has simple mail needs. He wants a mailbox on the Mac that syncs. It doesn't require him to reboot it 2 to 3 times a day. Yep. And, you know, I feel like I, you know, look bad telling him, hey, this is the issue. It's Apple's issue. Because I know that's the easy thing for me to say is, oh, it's an Apple problem. So I've actually found the support document where Apple recommends rebooting mail a couple times a day to fix it. And AirMail seems to be working great. And I realized yesterday how little Apple software I'm using now. And it's because of little issues like this that are frustrating. And it's good because it shows they have a strong ecosystem, but it's bad that they can't seem to make software that's stable ongoing.
Yeah, I think – I can't remember who it was that said it, but somebody observed that Apple kind of has this tendency to, instead of like doing the long-term maintenance on a lot of software just to kind of tear it down and start again. You know, and you saw that with, you know, the iWork reboot, if you like, on the Mac and Final Cut Pro 10 and iMovie as well, you know, that quite often what Apple will do is they'll have one piece of software for a while and then they'll just completely redo it for as a, you know, from scratch new thing. And, you know, I'm not saying that I think that, you know, for example, Apple Mail is being rewritten with a Final Cut Pro treatment or whatever, but yeah, I mean, I haven't used Apple Mail for, I'm thinking maybe like 4 generations now. Gmail, the web app, was the first actual web application that I ever really used on a regular basis. You know, because I was always like a native apps uber Alice kind of guy and couldn't get used to it. But, you know, I think a combination of my kind of general disgust at the whole concept of email and also just needing more powerful tools than... Because, I mean, Apple Mail, as good or bad as it is, it's essentially built on the same inbox and mailboxes model that all mail clients have been built with back to, like, I don't know, Pine or something like that, back in the day. And Gmail is the first one that has a kind of more modern model, if you like, of you know, the flagging and lots of filtering, and it's done in the cloud. And it was the, I think maybe the transition to iOS was the thing that made it happen mainly for me, because I was doing so much more email triage on the iOS devices that, you know, when I got back to the Mac, that was where I wanted to just do one or two little bits of email and get in and out really quickly.
Well, and it's simple, but the ability to integrate your attachments in with Gmail's web interface with Google Drive is incredible. I mean, you know, it's so effortless. Our teachers do that all the time, so no longer do they get the error messages about their attachments being too large. If it's too big to be a standard attachment, it just goes to Google Drive and drops a link in there. and it's effortless. And that's the kind of stuff that I feel like Apple is kind of not advancing their email program on. I mean, one of the things that Mailbox and AirMail do is they integrate in with Dropbox. Of course, Dropbox owns Mailbox, and so it's very easy to insert attachments from Dropbox and with just using a shared link. And if you look at Apple Mail, it's still roughly the same program as it was 2 or 3 years ago from a feature standpoint. And I'm not saying that they need to have all the power tools in the world, but they should have some of them.
Well, I mean, to be honest, it's very much the same kind of program as was in, you know, like every generation of OS X back to the public beta. I mean, sure, there have been features added and things, but it's not had a conceptual rethink. You know, probably since, in fact, you know, it was the Mail app on NextStep. It's essentially that model of an inbox and mailboxes that you manually put, you know, you manually put messages into or occasionally filter them into. But I think I just like the conceptual idea behind Gmail, you know, plus or minus whatever you think about Google. I don't really care, but I just think the way that Gmail is built for people who get hundreds of emails, you know, and that seems to be, from what I've read and what I've heard, that's kind of the email culture at Google, is just an overwhelming number of emails. And if you ever find yourself in the email trenches, the kind of tools that are built into Gmail, both just from a keyboard shortcut point of view in terms of getting through your email, but also the labeling and tagging and starring and different things that you can do with it is super powerful.
And the main reason I haven't gone Gmail only, especially at work, because we use Google Apps, is my personal mail is iCloud. And that's just, and obviously I know I could forward it, but I don't know. I've liked the iOS mail since it came out, and it still works fine. But then I'm using something like Mailbox for the first time, and it integrates in with iCloud and Gmail, and it kind of shows me some of the things that Apple's, I guess, not doing, or some of the advancements that have happened around, you know, Apple's, you know, platform. And I don't use all the things that Mailbox does, but just some of the ability to delete a message with one swipe instead of having to do a swipe and a tap. To me, it adds up over the course of a day because I delete a lot of email.
That's how to deal with a lot of emails, delete most of it, yeah. I mean, you're starting to see some things change, though, like the share link via iCloud.com for the iWork applications. You know, that's starting to become a thing. But again, the problem is that's not generalized, right? If you think about your Google Drive example, Bradley, you can put any file in Google Drive and share a link to it. Whereas with the share link via iCloud model, you can only do it with three applications. So, you know, it is what it is. But yeah, something a wee bit kind of more Dropboxy Google Drive, you might not go wrong.
Well, why is there not a contextual menu on the everywhere on the Mac? You right click, share this file, you know, via iCloud, and then pop up window with an email address.
Yeah, I mean, Google kind of want you to use their native file formats, and of course that works really, really well when you do that in Google Drive. But of course they've got viewers for a lot of other formats as well. So, and I had this bizarre experience the other day. I was on the web. I went to this website. It was a technical conference, and it said, here's the PDF of all the speakers. And it was a PDF hosted in Google Drive. And then it came up with a kind of embedded Google Drive viewer, and I just like was like, what am I seeing? I don't understand. There's a real sort of conceptual crash for my brain. But I mean, that was obviously a very easy thing for them to do as well. You know, take a file on Google Drive, embed it on the web. Done.
Yep. Easy as can be.
Yep. I'm turning into a Google Drive fanboy. What's happened to me?
Oh.
What has happened to me? Anyway, let's get back on the deployment series, Horace Bradley. What were we talking about tonight?
Well, we have a very interesting topic. I guess this would be week 4 of our 15-week series, and this is episode 76, and it's teacher training and development.
Always a very interesting topic. And, well, go ahead. Tell me what you think.
Well, I was going to say, you know, this topic is so broad because, you know, you have teachers at every skill level and at every stage of life and at every stage in their career. And, you know, you have a teacher that's, you know, 1 or 2 years out of school that's grown up in the Gmail generation that, you know, sees their worldviews on technology in the classroom are drastically different than someone who's 5 years away from retirement. And it's not that either one of them is right or wrong. They're just different. And that's where And so when we say training, it's going to be different from school to school and from grade to grade and from class to class.
Absolutely. And it's a real, again, to go back to, I guess, our first show, this is a real piece of leadership, right? This whole aspect of teacher training and development is really going to test your leadership skills in terms of correctly identifying who the people are who need, you know, either, you know, an arm around the shoulders or a kick up the backside or whatever to get moving or to get confidence or to, you know, be given some responsibility. That's, it's a real kind of people task, if you like, to just identify who needs what at which stage and make sure they get what they need.
Well, and I know this is tough for a lot of teachers, and it's tough for if you're responsible for training at your school. It's difficult because everything you're doing in some ways is an add-on to what's happening in the classroom. So if you hand them, if you hand a teacher a brand new Retina MacBook Pro and a 64 gig iPad Air, regardless of whether they use that in the classroom or not, they still have to teach and they still have goals they have to meet in the classroom, whether that be internal goals or, you know, state goals or countrywide goals. And so it's difficult because, you know, like me as a computer person, you know, you kind of have these goals that integrate in with what you do every day. So it's like, okay, let's get the Wi-Fi working. Let's get it deployed and make it work. And okay, you get that working, everybody's happy. You can kind of let that be and move on to the next thing. And so with teachers, they've got to, like, the integration is so difficult because they're still, you know, imagining it like they're running a race, and every school year is a race, and you come along on at the starting line and hand them new shoes. Well, they've got to put those shoes on, but regardless of whether they're comfortable or not or they get the laces tied, they've still got to run that race.
And it starts on that day.
Yes.
You know, there's no delaying, there's no pushing back, there's no deferring anything. It begins on day one, and you're going to be there till the end.
Yeah, and, you know, ultimately, they can't stop. There are no reboots. There's no, okay, we're going to start this school year over 3 weeks in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're live every day, you know, and you were talking about people who have got to do upgrades in production every year. In some ways, this is our upgrade in production, isn't it?
You know,
instead of changing a switch, it's changing what happens in the classroom as you're teaching in the classroom. You know, you can't. And I think this is one of my kind of key contentions about the whole process of technology adoption is that you can't do it in your head first. You know, a lot of schools that I talk to and a lot of people that come to me, they want to have sort of completely made the mental shift before they ever actually do it for real. And I think that's really, really hard. You know, there's schools who want to just wait until everything's perfect and they've thought through everything, and then they'll do it and it'll be perfect the first time. And of course, I mean, any transition is a high-risk strategy compared to just not doing it. You know, not doing what you're always doing is generally quite a safe thing, at least in the short term, although it may be very costly in the long term. But trying to kind of just be sure and guarantee that everything is going to be right is very, very difficult. I really believe that you've got to get the devices in and you've got to get hands-on. You've got to learn as you do, not from first principles, but, you know, from a reasonable baseline, if you like. There's obviously training you can do to start with, but then the further on you go, the more you have to kind of learn from your own experience and that of others.
Well, and so many people are doing so many different things. So if I'm a sales manager, or I'm a trainer at a company that sells widgets, and we're rolling out a new CRM application to our sales team, they're all pretty much going to do the same thing. You're going to enter this in this way. You're going to track this lead that way. You're going to close the deal this way. Well, in the classroom, it's different in every grade, in every classroom, at every school.
Yes. And I think, you know, one of the things that we conceptualized when we started with iPad was that, you know, we were sure that there would be a phase of use for iPads where, you know, children would use little apps and they would play wee games and they would do little drills and so on. And then eventually that would transition over into using an iPad the way you and I would use an iPad. And we certainly noticed that change, but I thought in my head and just with discussion with other teachers, we thought it would be sort of, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds. Turned out it was actually 6 and 7 year olds that transition happened. And by 8 years old, kids are using Keynote and Pages and, you know, iMovie, and they're making their own things. Whereas it's only the very youngest kids who are using it in that almost kind of toy model, if you like. And that was something that we thought we'd worked out in our heads first, and then it turned out it was completely wrong when we did it.
Yeah, it's just, I agree that it's, there's so much you learn on the ground floor. And that, I don't want to preface this with saying training is excellent and structured training is excellent, but don't expect to do a 4-class seminar at the beginning of your deployment and expect that to be the end of your training.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, sort of episodic development is much more important, I think, than just a big bang at the start of the year. And it's a kind of standard joke among people who do consultancy that the question, like, are you free on the 6th of January? It's just the one you get for like 4 months running up to Christmas, because everybody wants you on that first day, because every school's got, you know, a day set aside on the same day for their in-service development, and then they just do the rest of the term after that. But, you know, models where you can get training, you know, as you go along is obviously important as well.
Yeah, one of our reading framework is called Foundations and Frameworks, and so it requires really extensive training. Every new teacher goes through an intensive 2-week training class before they can start, and we have two of our teachers are certified to train. And what we do periodically throughout the year is we kind of have brainstorming sessions where teachers all get together. And we also have a time set up where our trainers actually will go and sit in the classroom and observe and work with and mentor other teachers doing the Foundations and Frameworks curriculum. And we've actually brought in the company, the school, other school that created it, we've brought in their trainers to help our teachers as well. Again, throughout the year, it's not just, you know, doing that training one time and hope you remember it forever. It's let's have refreshers. Let's actually work with our trainers on the ground floor and in the trenches. And one of the things that I had the idea to do is, you know, next year when we have our new teacher 2-week training, we should be filming that. And we should be breaking that up into topics and putting them, you know, somewhere privately, probably on Google Drive, honestly, where teachers can rewatch those throughout the year, because they may, as they're teaching, they may remember something back to their training. It'll make more sense now that they're actually doing it.
Yeah, most definitely. You know, once you, I remember they said something about this when this happened, do that, and, you know, being able to go back to those things is very important too, for
yes.
sure.
Yes.
Okay, so what I thought we would talk about, Bradley, is perhaps, you know, how do we baseline where teachers are at before we start our deployment? You know, what's our target for getting people trained and on board before we start versus what we're going to do during the deployment? And then what are the techniques, like what's available in terms of bringing people in or sending people out, or what other kinds of training are available in terms of, you know, preparing teachers to have their first day in the classroom with, say, a one-to-one iPad deployment. And then, obviously, as time goes on and they've learned new things, how do we facilitate them sharing that and getting more from other colleagues as well?
Before we move on, let's take a moment and thank our sponsor for the night. It's Redshift. They're back again this week. Business is constantly changing, and adapting is no longer a luxury. It's critical. How can your organization respond to today's business challenges? The answer is surprisingly simple. It's Redshift. 100% online suite of MBA-level Ivy League courses from Cornell University. Again, this is not a fly-by-night school. This is Cornell University. Working with experts on real-world projects vital to your business, your team will quickly gain the skills needed to drive growth, all for $500 or less per person. Again, all for $500 or less per person. Very inexpensive. Start building a culture of growth today by visiting ecornell.com/out of school. Again, that's ecornell.com/out of school. We'll have a link in the show notes. We'd appreciate if you visit their site if you're interested, and that link lets them know you heard about them from our show. So we want to thank Redshift for sponsoring the show this week.
Okay, good stuff. Yeah, see that thing, the culture of growth? That's essentially, you know, the subtitle of the whole show we're talking about, isn't it? Trying to develop a culture where it's okay for things to change in your school. That's the ballgame.
Because you think about it, let's go back to the business world. What businesses are the same today as they were 10, 15 years ago? They've had to evolve.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And schools are no different. I mean, obviously, most of us are nonprofits, but we're still a business. And the service we provide is education. So if we're still doing the same things we were doing 20 years ago and charging more for it, how was that possible? You know, you've got to you've got to evolve, even not just in technology, but just in the way you teach and the way you interact with students. Things have changed, and you've just got to evolve with it.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Yeah, it's always they talk about baseball pitchers that, you know, obviously maybe in their younger days they're power pitchers. But as they get older, they have to become more finesse pitchers because they're getting older. Their arms aren't as strong. And the ones who can't evolve just end up being done and having to retire early. But if you can evolve and develop a great curveball and a great changeup along with your fastball that's maybe, you know, 75% as good as it was before, well, you can keep pitching for years to come because you've evolved your game. And that's essentially what teachers have to do here, is they have to evolve the way they teach in the classroom.
Most definitely. So let's talk baseline. What can we do to kind of get a feel for where teachers are at to start with?
For me, look at what phones they have.
Okay. That's a really good indicator, isn't it?
Yeah, because if you've got a school full of flip phones, you're probably going to have more work to even, you know, let's say, assuming it's iOS you're deploying, you're going to have to, they have no foundations in iOS. Where if you look around your school, 95% of your faculty is carrying an iPhone. They're going to, when they see an iPad for the first time, it's going to look like a bigger iPhone.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing that we leveraged when we started with the iPad, was we looked around and we saw that, you know, 60 to 70% of teachers already had an iPhone. And we said, people, look, you're already carrying this thing in your pocket. This one's just bigger. And that, you know, lazy knock against the iPad that it was just a bigger iPhone, well, that's the best thing that it could have possibly have been, right? Imagine it had been some other kind of platform. These people had adopted the Mac, and then they'd adopted personally the iPhone, and then I'm asking them to adopt a third platform. Yeah, that would not have been an easy sell. But the fact that those two things dovetailed so well together, both in time and also in their experience, was really, really powerful.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, imagine if you had a desktop and you gave someone a laptop and it was running a different OS. It's like, well, yeah. It's harder. It's a harder sell when they're having, you know, not only is the form factor changing, but also the software, the apps change, the interactions change. You know, even things like double tapping the home button, those things are just so muscle memory to iPhone users that it just flows. And you're right, that knock against the iPad was it was a big iPhone. In the technical world, that seems like a knock. But for regular people, that's a bonus.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you remember that the first iPad advert that came out on TV. It was, you know, this is iPad. It's thin. It's light. It goes everywhere. There's no way to hold it and stuff like that. And there's a great line in the advert where the narrator said, "Da da 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 da. You already know how to use it." And to me, that was kind of like the hook for a lot of what we did, was that people did already know in large part how to use the iPad. And obviously, there were some, you know, there are some UI changes, idiom changes in the iPad, but not that many compared to, you know, the changes from iOS to any desktop platform, for example. So I think if you're starting today, and obviously the listeners we hope for this series are people who are starting today, I think you should recognize that you're working in a very different context to my kind of historical war stories of what we did back in 2010, because back then, and I was telling this to a visitor to school today, I said, look, back in 2010, we were still trying to explain to people what an iPad was. You know, that first parents' information evening we had, it wasn't about the pedagogical value or otherwise of the iPad. It was about, what on earth is an iPad? And what can it do? Is it a computer? Is it a game thing? You know, what is it? You know, and you know, we spent a lot of time back then just explaining to people, look, this is a computer, same as you know on the laptop, except, you know, it looks a bit different, it works a bit different, but it's still got a word processor, it's still got a presentation, a package, and so on and so on. And in some ways, it was a kind of reassurance job, whereas today, I think, based on, you know, my experience of going to schools and talking to parents' evenings and so on, I did one not so long ago in London, which was really, really good, because the conversation was not about whether or not the iPad was a good thing. The conversation was about how does it enhance the teaching and learning that's going on in the school. And I think it was really great. The parents came and, you know, they were prepared to have that level of conversation rather than the why aren't you using Windows conversation, which is what, you know, I spent the first couple of years kind of batting back and forth at those kind of events. And it's a very different world today than it was even just 3 or 4 years ago.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And it's kind of like you've gotten past the scared, I guess, culture of it, where it's like it's a new thing. It's so ingrained in our lives now that it's almost, if you're not using technology in the classroom, and specifically iPads, people ask you, why not? And it's brought the focus back to the classroom and to the curriculum rather than just about toys or arguments over Exchange versus Google or Mac versus Windows. It's, you know, we funnel it back to the classroom.
Yeah, I think it seems to me that if iPad in classroom was the gimmick that some people said it was 5 years ago or 4 years ago, that we wouldn't be seeing the adoption rate that we're seeing now. You know, and I think I've heard numbers that suggest that something like half of all UK schools have got at least one iPad in the building. I don't know how many are larger deployments than that, but I think that's a stat that I've heard bounced about a couple of times, and it seems a bit reasonable. You know, a lot of schools are trying to buy one or two themselves, and obviously we've advocated for bigger, more planned and more structured deployments than that, but, you know, it gets us up to that interesting number. So you're starting to see it's possibly true that the majority of schools now in the UK, for example, are using iOS in some form.
Well, and the Apple's growth, and just in mind share, not market share, but mind share, has made this, again, you're no longer having to convince people about Apple.
Yes.
You know, it's an expensive brand, or it's too expensive, or it's just for designers, and that's, you know, things we dealt with back in 2005, 2006, before I was even in this industry. You can just, it's almost like understood that Apple makes great devices for education, and maybe your argument, or the argument you get is, why an iPad versus a Mac? And there's both are great devices for the classroom. Don't get me wrong, but if your plan is to go iPad, that's probably one of the questions you're going to get. And that's a great question to have instead of, you know, why are we not deploying netbooks?
Remember netbooks?
Ah, that was the rage in 2009. That was the rage.
I still have a Dell Mini 9 on my desk at school, which I believe if I could get it to start up, would start up into Leopard. Don't tell Apple Legal that I said that. But I remember looking at that, and we had a couple of netbooks in school, and I'm almost as proud of the things that we didn't buy as the things that we did buy. And that was one thing that, you know, everybody, I mean, I think people don't remember the pressure that was on schools to get netbooks in like 2009, sorry. It almost got to the point where it was like orthodoxy that netbooks were the future of educational computing. Almost. And then the iPad just came out and killed it, you know, almost overnight. I think a lot of the backlash in the very first year of iPad in education was from people who had very recently advocated the purchase of very large netbook installations, and they had a little bit of a rearguard action to do at that point. But fortunately, you know, that technology cycle is leaving us now, and everybody can kind of come on board with, and I'm not saying come on board with iPad as such, but come on board with the idea that tablets are a much more appropriate form factor for most tasks in the school than a crunched down little laptop. And if I look at that Mini 9 today, and I look at that, I think, did we ever think this was okay? You know, people want to talk about how hard it is to type on an iPad. I mean, come and have a shot of my Dell Mini 9. The keyboard's like, you know, the size of an iPad Mini, and it's even smaller than an iPad Mini, I would say. And you know, it's just impossible to type on it. And people are saying that iPads are the ones that are hard to type on.
And you look at those devices, and that mindset was, all we will do in the classroom is word processing and do citations inside said report. And because they had 1 gig of RAM, and that's, again, you know, I know that, you know, of course my phone has 1 gig of RAM, but you know, in 2008, 2009, 1 gig in any sort of PC was very underpowered. It was still running Windows XP. And when we marginalize what we'll do in the classroom to just doing Microsoft Word, that makes me a little sad. And I don't think that the market for those, I think people's intentions were good on trying to make something simple. I get that. The problem is it wasn't simple. It was still Windows, and it had all the baggage of Windows, and it was just a small, poorly made computer. Because
well, yeah, I mean, it was never a simple product. It was just a cheap product.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you want a simple laptop, a very, very simple laptop, I would say get a Chromebook.
Well, you know, I think one of my contentions about Chromebook, and I have one right here on my desk, so I'm not knocking Chromebook in any way, but I think Chromebook seem to only really be taking any serious hold in education. And in particular, a model I see quite a lot now, and I don't know if you've seen this, Bradley, is that schools will get iPads from like first grade and they'll use it all the way up until they start doing like serious exams, and then they get a Chromebook. And I think my sort of contention about that is that that's a sort of tacit admission that exam level, you know, terminal exams in schools essentially can't be reformed. Right? They're going to be essay-based, they're going to be report-based, and they're just going to be like that, you know, I guess kind of forever, you know. And the fact that if you can use iPads further down the school, why can't you use iPads at that level in the school? What's the disconnect between those two parts of education that mean that iPads are suitable up until you get into some kind of exam criteria? And I'm not talking just about Scotland, I'm talking worldwide. I've seen it in American schools, I've seen it in Australian schools, I've seen it in English schools as well. What's the disconnect between those two parts of your educational process that makes that the most appropriate choice at both stages, and why is there such a sharp cutoff at that point? It's an interesting question to ponder, I think.
Yeah, it's to me, it comes down to a lot of it's just bad development, bad programming. My wife was ordering new checks last night, and she pulled out her laptop, which seemed appropriate, ordering checks from a laptop. And I said, why are you just not doing that from your phone or your iPad? Again, not that I care, but I'm always curious about questions like that. And she said, because most of the time when I go to like our bank website, it sends me to like their crappy mobile page. Mm. And it wasn't that it was like, I don't like doing that. It's just that it doesn't work. And they try to like, you know, wrap around me and give me something else I don't want. And, you know, again, so it's not the device, it's where she's going.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, like, what would the world be like if we didn't have iOS and there was no app store? Because the world was largely headed to the web. Mm-hmm. And then the iPhone and the iPhone SDK brought that back to the app level. And so, like, you can imagine in a bizarre world where there is no iOS that Chromebooks would be taking off like crazy worldwide.
Oh, I completely agree. And I think it was, I'm trying to remember which journalist it was. I think it was Charles Arthur in The Guardian posted a question on Twitter, and he asked people, he said, look, name for me the last major software product that launched on the desktop and was wildly popular worldwide. And I think the most recent one he could come up with was iTunes. You know, which is like 2001, what iTunes was the first released. You know, and everything in the last sort of 10 or 12 years since then has essentially been web first on the desktop before the mobile revolution really started with the iPhone in 2007. Everything that happened between essentially iTunes and then was a web product, you know, and rightly so, because it hit all the platforms on the desktop. But mobile is a different story.
Yes.
Anyway, we're way off topic here. Way off topic. Are we? I think we certainly wandered off topic a little bit. So two more questions I want to pose to you, Bradley. We're going to target people in the school, okay? And what are we going to do for them? Right? These are the two key questions. And I don't know if you've seen this curve that people throw around called the technology adoption cycle, which... How do we look at it? And I've not read this book, but it seems to come from a book called The Diffusion of Innovations by Everett Rogers. And it's a kind of bell curve kind of thing. But what the author does is he slices the bell curve into sections and he gives them a name, and he talks about the innovators, that sort of 2.5 to 3% who are at the leading edge of everything. And I would like to think that the people who are listening to this series are those people in their school. They're the people who see the future. They're highly engaged with it, and they want to move things forward. And then behind them comes about 14% of the whole population who are what you might call early adopters, who are quite closely engaged, but they're not necessarily the absolute visionary edge, the way that the innovators might be. And then you've got the early majority and the late majority who make up the majority of that this kind of hump in the middle of the bell curve. And the author puts that around 34% of the population each, 34% in the early majority and 34% in the late majority. And then he gives a figure of about 16% for these laggards, these people who are the last to adopt any technology, who are typically older, less educated, and perhaps have less actual or social capital to spend on changes like this. And that's a that's a model. Are you familiar with that model, Bradley?
I believe I've heard about it before.
Mm-hmm. It's a way to think about it, you know. And I think the way that I look at it in school is that once you've got to the early majority on board, you're halfway there. And numerically, that's what Everett Rogers says in this model, is that by the time you get the early majority on board, you're up to 50%. Then the late majority follow on pretty easily behind, but then there's always going to be this long tail of people. And I think one of the things that kind of mires a lot of schools trying to get into some kind of deployment like this is when leadership worries that they have to get 100% of people on board before they can even start. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
This model suggests there's always going to be 10 to 15% of people who are going to take a very long time to come on board, whatever it is you do. So the focus, I think, should correctly be on the early majority. Those innovators, you know, our listeners, hopefully, and early adopters who are probably listening to the show as well, they'll kind of do whatever's new and hot and suits their purposes. The early majority are people who generally, you know, they don't care that much. And the late majority certainly don't care that much, but they can be quite easily swayed over, you know. And I think if you do that leadership part that we talked about in the first show, if you do that correctly and get the message and the vision across, you can bring a lot of those people on board very easily. And then obviously you can work your way down to the end as the process goes on. But I think the key message from that model is don't worry about that 10% at the end. Don't kill yourself to try and get them on board in the first week or month of the trial, or the trial or even the deployment.
You know, I might even say the first year.
Mm-hmm.
Let them have a year of just testing the waters and tinkering and learning. Because if you look at like the model you've presented as kind of a snowball, and every time you get a group on board, the snowball gets bigger by that percentage. And when you know, after that, say, first year, and you've got the, you know, everybody but that last group of people, then they're going to feel pressure in some ways to learn and to evolve. Because it's not just the head of the school and the IT person and the technical coordinator pushing it. It's all, they're seeing all their peers doing it as well. And, you know, peer pressure works. I mean, let's be real.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be surprised about some of the foundational skills that they can learn in first year without necessarily being pushed, but they'll learn how to, you know, maybe do some basic things on the device. And as you do, mm-hmm. maybe in year two, or maybe towards the end of year one, start working with them more heavily, they'll start to get it.
Yeah. I think the key thing there is to give everybody some reason to pick up the device. And one of the changes we made just before we went iPad was that the decision was made that all school announcements would only go out via email, that we would no longer be printing announcements and sending them around to school. And that was a big deal for some of those people who might be described as laggards in our group, that gave them a reason just to pick up their iPad just to see what was going on in the school that day or whatever. And something like that, it can be incredibly powerful. The other thing that can be incredibly powerful for that late majority and the laggards is to see somebody from the leadership team taking an enthusiastic and active part in the deployment. So, for example, seeing, you know, a member of the senior management team walking around the school with their iPad, bringing their iPad to meetings, you know, typing on their iPad, and just being seen to be a user, but somebody senior in the process, it can also be incredibly powerful as well. A very simple thing to do, but very effective.
Yeah, it's kind of like if they can do it, I should be able to do it too. And again, so the, you know, the idea is if they're picking up their iPad to read their email to get the announcements, then they think, oh, I need to look something up real quick. You know, why I have this here, let's look this up. And again, that goes back to why the iPad being so great that it's, you know, always on, it's always ready to work. There's no boot up time, it just works.
There's no impediment to picking it up and getting a task done. Exactly, yeah. So that's a way to think about who you need to target with your professional development. Now, I'm not saying that there's a chunk of your teachers that you should just cut out of professional development opportunities. Of course not. But at the same time, you've got to try and, if you're trying to do a massive culture shift in your school, you have to focus your resource and your, and not only just money, but also your time and effort on those people who will make a, whose participation in the program will make a big difference to your agenda, which is essentially normalizing this change. Right, that's the key. The key thing you want to do is you want to make it normal that we use iPads in the school. That it's not something that is a special day when I take my iPad into the classroom, or it's a special thing when somebody pulls out their iPad in a meeting. You want that to be absolutely the normal way as quick as possible. The quickest way to get to that is to get to your early majority. And then you've got 50% of people who are just normally, regularly part of the change that you've wanted to see happen in the organization.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's there's no perfect formula here. You're going to have to understand your culture, where you're starting, understand your people, understand what motivates them. And you know, my headmaster's always talked about that, like, when a new head comes into a school, they should really wait a year before making drastic changes. They should come in and observe. And because you learn these things when you observe, you learn people's, you know, tendencies and their what drives them and what their fear is and what motivates them. And not, you don't do that to manipulate them, but to just understand them and get to know them. And so you can, if you do need to make changes in their classroom, you've at least spent the time learning how they do things. You're not just not walking in the first day saying, what you're doing is terrible, here's the new plan.
Oh, most definitely, yeah. I completely agree with that. I think it's essential to understand your people first. You know, whether or not you're new to it, you may not, even if you've been there for a number of years, you may not have done a change as big as this. You may not ever have done a change as big as this anywhere in your career so far. I mean, this is going one-to-one is such a big deal in the life of a school, because it's essentially, it's one of the few changes that's essentially irreversible. Do you know what I mean? Like, curriculums come and go and they change, and you can change your reading scheme, but, and of course you can change your one-to-one platform if you like, but the change between going one-to-one and going back to not being one-to-one, I imagine, although I have certainly seen programs being reversed, but I imagine it's an incredibly difficult step to go backwards to back to that old model of shared computers and computer labs and so on, rather than having a full one-to-one experience.
Yeah, I agree. Once you go, there's no going back.
So let's talk a little bit about techniques. Like, how, what is it, what can you provide to people to help them get up to speed with something like an iPad deployment in your school? Now, there's a couple of Apple-specific things I want to talk about here, and some of them are generalizable as well. But in the Apple world in particular, there's a thing called Apple Professional Development. I don't know if you're familiar with this, Bradley.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Are you an Apple Professional Development trainer?
Not yet.
No, not yet.
Not yet.
They'll get you eventually.
I hope. Does it pay well?
It's okay. There's a couple of interesting things about Apple Professional Development and also how it's paid for as well. What happens is that Apple obviously want iPad deployments to work, right? And one of the things that can be provided as part of a reseller, you know, this is in the European model, as part of a reseller selling a large bulk of iPads to a school, is that Apple will pay them a certain amount of money to provide Apple Professional Development training for their staff, okay? And that money goes back to the reseller, and the reseller can use that to hire an Apple Professional Development trainer. Not anybody is an Apple Professional Development trainer. You have to be sort of trained by Apple first, and then you can be part of that system. I actually am an Apple Professional Development trainer. So if you are buying iPads and you want and you want to hire me for your school, ask your reseller if they can pay for it for you. But the original idea of Apple Professional Development, Apple has defined a number of courses that that APD trainers can deliver. And they have titles like Language Arts Learning with iPad, or Vision and Plan is one of them. And we've mentioned Apple Professional Development in the first show, I'm sure, as well. And there's different kinds of titles. I think there's also an accessibility one now as well, and different things. And the original idea was that it was by educators for educators. so that people like me who are teachers in school could be hired by other schools or by resellers to go to other schools and deliver these courses. And that was the model. What's happening now a little bit in Europe is that resellers are hiring teachers and they're putting them on payroll. And then whenever they make a sale and they get the money back to do Apple professional development training, what happens is they'll send their guy out to do it, right? So it's not so often that you're necessarily getting somebody who is working in the classroom every day as a teacher with responsibility for a class, as much as somebody who once was a teacher and is now an employee of the reseller and is doing these APD sessions on a regular basis. And I'm not necessarily saying one's better than the other, but the by educators for educators mantra has kind of been watered down a little bit by the involvement of people who are on staff at resellers instead of just people who are in the classroom under normal circumstances.
And of course, that can be a good thing because just being a good teacher doesn't make you a great trainer of how to deploy things mm-hmm. and how to do things. And so if you've got someone that the only thing they do is training, they get to hone that skill a little bit more. But also as time goes on, their classroom experience probably has less and less to do with how they do training.
Yes, I think there's plus and minuses both ways. And I think what it also does is having these people working in the resellers means that the resellers can become more education focused. You know, that I think that helps as well. So, but as far as I know, and I'm not speaking on behalf of Apple here or anything, but as far as I know, there's no reason why you can't ask your reseller to hire a specific person to do your APD training. They may not want to do it if they've put somebody on payroll. They might want to. Obviously, the margins are better if they don't have to hire somebody like me, but you could, you know, if you wanted to have me specifically for whatever reason, you could in principle ask for that. You might not get it, but you could ask for it. So Apple Professional Development is quite a good course. And there's a range of them. I very much like to hear of people doing the vision and plan one, but more often schools don't necessarily want to burn their budget on just training the senior management team on the deployment as much as they want to have it. All the teachers brought up to speed on, say, maths and language on the iPad. So there's different courses for different reasons. And there's a catalogue you can look at before you decide what it is you get. So that's typically a kind of one-off thing. You know, the reseller is not going to pay for, you know, 10 or 15 days of Apple professional development training over the course of a year. You might get one or two, depending on how many devices you buy, and then the school might have to pay for more after that. Because obviously schools can hire APD trainers directly to do other parts of APD. It doesn't always have to be through a reseller, but you know that can sometimes be how the relationship starts. And then from there, the school will develop a relationship with the trainer directly and have them back more and more often as well. So that's one thing you can do. The Apple Store is a very tricky one. Now, I know, Bradley, you don't live very near an Apple Store. I have the good fortune to live very close to two, and they're both very good in different ways. One's a mall store, the one at Bray Head near Glasgow Airport, and then the other one is, for now, Scotland's flagship store, which is in Glasgow, in Buchanan Street. And we have a great relationship with those people at the Apple Store. We don't buy our devices through them. We did the first time, but we don't do that anymore. But we still have a really good relationship with the people there, and we know they can help us out. And we occasionally do events at the Apple Store, either on education or just on deployment as well. So it's a good relationship to have, although the Apple Store, at least in the UK, I don't know about the US, Bradley, in the UK, they don't have a formal remit to do education type training. That's all about Apple professional development, and it's through the education team in the UK. Do you know of schools getting involved with Apple stores directly in the US?
Well, I don't know of that offhand because, again, we don't live near one. But I know our local Mac reseller, they have classes all the time. Mm-hmm. But I imagine that if you tried to go as a school and tried to buy a block of training, they would have to tell you no.
Yeah, I know in the US they have more direct things from Apple as well. Although I'm not familiar with exactly what they are, so I don't want to make a guess.
You know, knowing that every school has a team at Apple, you've got a kind of an outside account rep, an inside account rep, and then the systems engineer that's assigned to your account. I imagine you have to everything has to go through them, and they really seem to want to funnel all the education stuff through that team. And I get that because they want to make sure that if you are buying a, you know, buying a block of devices, that you're prepared to do that, whether it be through the training, whether it be having the right network in place, that they're not wanting someone to go out and buy 150 iPads at the Apple store and then, you know, not be prepared to how to manage them, how to deploy them, things like that.
Yeah. Yep. It's always a little confusing in the UK because a lot of schools think they can just go to the Apple store and start getting helped to do a deployment. And in fact, there's this kind of distinction in the UK between the education team and Apple and the retail team, such that you don't often have the kind of relationship with the retail staff that we have because of our historic links. That was how we did our first deployment, was we just did a business lease through the Apple store in Glasgow, and that was how our relationship developed with them. That was before sort of, well, to be honest, it's before I knew what resellers were. the only place I knew to get Apple products was the Apple store. So I went to the Apple store and I said, how can I get these iPads? Obviously, I'm far more sophisticated now, and I'm not sure I'm all the better for knowing these things now, but so it goes. That's a kind of Apple specific thing as well, the retail store team. More broadly, though, there are independent consultants. And I know, Bradley, you've been to some schools on a consultancy basis, and it's something that, as listeners will know, I do all the time, is going and helping other schools either plan or set up or talk to parents about their deployment or train their teachers or whatever it is they need done, based on my experience having done it in our school as well. And hiring people who've done it before is incredibly powerful. It's a really, really good way to go. If you don't know where to start, find somebody who's done it before and have them show you the way.
Yeah, and again, don't be afraid to call up another school and say, hey, can we hire someone from your school for the day or the afternoon? Or, you know,
absolutely.
I mean, you know, I think the neat thing is about, you know, we obviously compete with other schools, but the neat thing about it is we share information. Certainly in the IT department, IT area, we share information. And maybe you don't do that among the admissions department. They probably don't cross train, but you know, I'm certainly willing to take a half day off from here and go help another school out, because I'll learn a lot as well in the process.
Yeah, that's for sure. And it's been one of the greatest kind of development experiences of my career as well, to have the opportunity that I have, which I know so many teachers don't ever get, to visit schools in other countries, working under different education systems. It's been an absolute, you know, okay, I get paid for it, yes, but I regard it as valuable professionally as, you know, the money side of it, you know, which is, the money is great, don't get me wrong, but it's not, meeting people and understanding what they do is every bit as enriching for me as anything financial as well. So, you know, here's a 2-second slot. If you do want to hire me, and I'm sure, Bradley, the same goes for you, just drop us a line. We travel internationally, and well, I don't know if you do, Bradley, but I certainly seem to be never done getting on planes.
Well, and I'm $5 less per hour than Fraser. So if you're wanting to save $5, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
I have to charge sales tax.
I sell my stuff through Amazon.
Yeah, well, I'm looking for another excuse to get to the US. So any American schools, get in touch. I need to pick up some cooking supplies for my wife. Yeah, get some of that sweet potato stuff you keep talking about.
Ah, it's delicious.
So independent consultants are a great way to go. I know there's people, I mean, I'm an amateur in this regard compared to some people I know who are just booked up day after day after day just throughout the whole year, and they do a great job with that stuff. I'm harder to get because I have teaching commitments, but there are times in the year and I can be a little bit flexible as well. So it's something to bear in mind. And of course, I have the thing that I do a bit differently to some other people is I can do the technical side, you know, top to bottom, as well as doing the teaching side, as well as doing the school management side. And there's not to put too fine a point on it, there's not that many people around who have done all of those things. There's people who have done the technical side, there's people who have done the school leadership side, and there's people who have had it in their classroom. But I've actually been one of the few people, I guess, who have done all three of those. And, you know, if that makes me a more valuable proposition to you, then so be it.
Well, I think you're right, because all those three areas are drastically different, but they're very key. But every person in there speaks a different language.
Yeah.
and they're motivated by different things. And so understanding that allows you to communicate better to those folks, you know, how this will affect them and how it will affect them for the good.
Absolutely. You know, and I think credibility is such a big thing with teachers. You know, people who are not teachers coming in to tell teachers what to do is not often a message that's very well received, to put it mildly. So having somebody who is a teacher and has done that come in and sit down with your teachers, you know, it's something I've done as well, consulting with teachers or talking to senior management, or, you know, usually what happens is I go to school, I'll present to the whole school, I'll talk to various groups, and then I'll have an hour sitting down with the IT people as well. And, you know, it's a fun day to try and take off all these different hats and put on different hats at different times. But I really, really enjoy that when I get the opportunity to do it as well. It's really, really
good. Well, it's one of those areas where being a generalist really helps. You know, maybe you're not the best system administrator in the entire world. Maybe you can't.
How dare you?
Yeah, maybe you don't. Maybe you're not a Cisco expert, but yeah, you can talk You can talk to a Cisco person about how this will affect them and some things they need to be looking for. And being able to, because you know what you're doing is you're fitting puzzle pieces together here, and you know those schools generally have a specific person that's going to kind of, you know, plug their piece in, and if they can have an idea of what this will do for them, all the better.
Yeah, no, that's definitely the way it works. Yeah. You've already mentioned, Bradley, another development opportunity is going on a school visit. And I'm sure your school gets visited a lot. Mine certainly does. I had visitors in today, earlier on today. And I think that's a very, very powerful experience.
Oh, I agree. And I love going to other schools, more so than conferences, more so than just about anything. I love going to other schools because I feel like just getting to see someone else's environment is, you know, it's so refreshing to see maybe I'm doing something that I've always done, but there's a better way to do it. Maybe, I mean, again, something as simple as the way we wire our switch closets or the way, you know, or how the iPads are stored in the classroom when they're not in use, just little things, but it's just refreshing to get out of your environment, take off your, you know, you're the hat you wear every day and just learn and just walk around and learn. And we love having people in. We have people in, you know, often. And it's just awesome to get to walk around and show off our school. We hope they enjoy it as well and get a lot out of it. And of course, I talk to people weekly about whether it's Wi-Fi or whether it's iOS deployment questions. And it's just so much fun to get to talk to, you know, people in my same role at other schools, because you really learn that every deployment is different, and there's no, like, you know, cookie cutter model, because every school is different. Every building is different.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the way that I might describe it is, like, there's not a template, but there's a kind of jig for it. You know, there's a scaffolding that goes around it, and there's, you're going to have to build some of the same parts, but they might not be the exact same shape as the ones that we've built. You know, that's kind of the way I would describe it. And yeah, going to other schools is super, and I find when we have people come to visit us, the only thing I wish is that they brought more people. You know, people often come in ones or twos, and I know it's hard to get several teachers out of school at the same time, but I always say to people as they leave, you know, if you want to come back, bring more people next time, bring different people next time. Because what I believe is that in particular, that kind of early and late majority, those people who are not diehard against or mad keen for, if you can bring those people to a school visit, they are the people whose eyes will be opened, right? Because they are not, they may present to you as being skeptics, but quite often what it is it's not that they're skeptical, it's just that they can't actually imagine what that would be like. And bringing them to a school visit where they can see it in action, they can see, you know, for those who maybe are fearful, they can see that the world hasn't ended, that it still looks like a school, it still works like a school, and learning happens in a world where these devices are commonplace, then you can really get those people on board in a very powerful way by taking them on a school visit to a school where you've seen what they can do and how they've adopted the technology. And once they see it, they know what it would be like. They can start to put themselves in the place of what they've seen, and they can start to take it forward from there. It's a very, very powerful motivational tool for that particular group of people. You know, what often happens is that people bring their iPad champions, right? They bring the keen people. And I kind of wish they had brought one keen person and five people who were kind of unsure and didn't really understand it that well. Because then we could have shown those people and they could have gone back and started some fires where they were. So if you are planning some kind of visit like that, don't just take the fanboys, right? Take the people who just don't quite understand it yet and show them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, oftentimes people that are resistant to technology feel threatened by when it's like a big drastic change. Mm-hmm. And so by if a school is investing in them and sending them places to learn, I think it's reassuring to the teacher that, hey, they're not trying to push me out. They're trying to help me. You know, they're investing absolutely back in me.
Yep. Yep. Most definitely. That's a big, big part of it as well, for sure.
Because, you know, I feel that way. When I'm sent on a week-long training to broaden my skill set, it makes me think that they're hoping I'm here for a long time and not wanting to, you know, fire me the next week.
Definitely. No. That's a real signal, particularly in times, you know, like in the UK and I'm sure in the US as well, that budgets are tighter. And if budget can still be found to do these kind of things for key members of staff, then that sends a signal by itself. So the last thing I wanted to mention in terms of what you could do is sending people to a conference. Now you said, Bradley, you prefer to go and visit a school and go to a conference, and I think I would agree with that. But there are some conferences that have a certain amount of value, but there aren't that many sort of specific iPad conferences yet, I don't suppose. There's educational technology conferences, yes. I mean, I know you've been to ISTE, Bradley. There's BET in the UK as well. There's the Scottish Learning Festival, which I've been to in years past. And those can be good, but they can often be a bit general. I don't know if you felt that with your trip to ISTE last year.
Yeah, it's a great conference, but they're trying to cram so much in such a broad topic.
Yeah. I remember the Scottish Learning Festival, which is a kind of similar but smaller event in Glasgow. It's essentially like in two parts. There's like seminars on one side and there's a trade show on the other, and there's all these stalls. You go around this big trade show hall. And it was very funny because nobody was at the interactive whiteboard booth. Nobody was at the microscope booth. Nobody was anywhere except there was like a five deep rugby scrum of teachers at this one stall. And I was sitting there with my colleague and looking, going, what are they selling over there at the stall? And we eventually kind of poked our heads over the crowd to see what it was they were selling. And it was a stall that was just selling stickers. Just like stickers for kids, all kinds of stickers about everything you can imagine. And there was just like a riot of people trying to get into the stall and buy stuff off that stall. And I don't know if that was all the budget these people had to spend, or if it was just that was the thing that motivated people much more than, 4K televisions and interactive whiteboards and Wi-Fi and stuff, was just stickers. But yeah, you know, who doesn't love a sticker? So there are a couple of, I don't know if you've had much to do with the EdTech teacher organization in the US.
No.
No. I know a friend of the show, Don Orth, who was on the show a couple of times last summer, he's involved with EdTech teacher in California, and they do run some summits. I think they're called the EdTech teacher iPad summit, which are apparently, I've never been to one, but I've heard that they're very good. And of course, Apple have a couple of events as well. I don't know what their US schedule is like, but I know in January every year in London, they have the Leadership Summit for the Europe, Middle East and Africa region, the GEO, as Apple calls them. And there's also a thing called the Apple Learning Tour that goes around Europe as well, which I have been on from time to time. I've spoken at a couple of those events in Switzerland and in the Netherlands, which is a kind of one-day event or two-day event in a hotel somewhere where they'll bring in both Apple speakers to give the kind of Apple message, but also sometimes international speakers like myself and sometimes local speakers from local schools as well to share their story along with perhaps a workshop component as well. The model varies a little bit from time to time, but those are also opportunities that you could find to send people on. And certainly in Europe, resellers will be aware of when those events are coming to your area, and we'll be able to kind of advise along with other things.
Yeah, and I think the key takeaway is to spend as much time in the company of other people that are doing your job as possible.
Yeah.
Whether that's a teacher, a headmaster, as IT director, just hang out with them, get to know them, collaborate, be their friends, and then I think that leads to a lot of sharing of information and ideas.
That's the key thing. It's all about the hallway track in these events. It's not necessarily about the sessions, although, I like to think I do a reasonable job, but, you know, I think the most value that people get out of those sessions is the conversations, either with, you know, sometimes with me, sometimes with just other people nearby who are doing their job. It's it's incredibly valuable to just have that opportunity to take some time and to have conversations and gain learning from other people. Super powerful. Okay, well, that's the kind of bulk of the thing. I just wanted to mention a couple of other things. Once you kind of get up and running, bringing the conversation back to your school is really important. You know, it's great to send a couple of people on training courses or visits, but it's always important to kind of be able to disseminate that when you get back to your own school. And there's a couple of ways that you can do that. I mean, we often talk about like a learning conversation. You know, that's kind of the phrase at the moment in terms of how schools get better, is to keep a learning conversation going. You talk about what you do in the classroom, talk about your practice and so on. And to bring the iPad program or your technology program into that conversation is incredibly important. So it's important to foster a culture of growth, like we said in the sponsor read. Culture of sharing your practice as well is really, really important. And smaller schools, that will happen very organically. That it will happen just in over lunch. It will happen in the staff room. It will happen over coffee. Bigger schools, I think, have to do a wee bit of work to formalize that and make sure that that learning, that practical experiential learning, gets shared across the school in a much more holistic way than it would just happen accidentally with two friends talking. You know, when you've got 100 teachers, it's going to be a lot harder for everybody to talk to everybody else. So sometimes, do you do anything like that in your school, Bradley? We've done it in the past. We don't tend to do it so much anymore.
Yeah, we don't as much anymore. A lot of our stuff, again, we're small. And so I find a lot of that comes, I make it a point to walk the halls a lot. And I've done that, especially in the past month or two. I just walk the halls and talk to people and sit down. And, you know, teachers are in the break room, go in there and stop and say, hey, how's it going? Anything I can help you with? And you'll be surprised how they've maybe been thinking about something and just have never found the right time to ask you, and they'll ask you there. And so that, you know, it's just interesting how that works.
Yeah, I've seen in bigger schools, I've seen things like, you know, lunchtime events where, you know, three people will come and just share one thing that happened in their classroom. I've talked to schools where they've, there's a thing in the UK called Teach Meet, which is a kind of self-organized, unconference kind of thing for teachers. And there's a Teach Meet tablet event, I think, happened this week in Glasgow. One focused around tablets. But I've also heard of schools who are sort of using that brand internally as well. And they're having like internal Teach Meets, they're calling them, where they'll just say, you know, after school, we're going to all get together. Everybody brings like a 2-minute topic. We're going to share it. And then, you know, there's maybe some food or we go out for dinner or something afterwards as well. So that can be a powerful thing. If you can build up some kind of brand or name it something, that can be a powerful thing. And just make it a regular thing. Not even something that everybody has to come to. It doesn't have to be mandatory. In fact, it's probably better that it's not. But you'll see that if you can make it a safe place for that early and late majority to come and share what they've done, along with the super fans who have been the innovators and the visionaries, that can be a really powerful thing to do in your school as well.
And it goes back to that culture thing. And, you know, if you have a toxic culture, maybe people don't get along. It's going to be tougher to get things like this going. But if you've got staff that, you know, genuinely like each other, it's a whole lot easier to kind of get these events going where, again, it can be super informal. Maybe, you know, the tech person and a couple of savvy teachers are just going to hang out in the teacher's lounge after school one day a week and say, hey, we're here for any questions or, you know, anything like that. If you have a great culture, those things are easier to put into place.
Absolutely. Yep. But do try, you know, always try. Start small. You know, maybe if it even is that 3% of the, you know, the visionaries and the early adopters start with, but then make sure people know about it. You know, in a bigger school, sometimes the biggest problem is just letting people know about it. Mm-hmm. Put a poster up, raise people's awareness of it.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be complicated or expensive.
No, I agree. And certainly the bigger schools, you've probably got to have something a little, as you said, more formal. So people, you know, don't expect the word of mouth. You don't expect word of mouth to travel like that in the bigger schools. Mm-hmm. But don't, you know, don't miss out on what good just walking around after school or even in the morning saying, hey, how's it going? Anything I can help with? Any questions you have? Just people appreciate that. That goes a long way, even if they don't need help, but they know you're willing to help.
Yeah, most definitely. And I suppose that's kind of the message of staff development. You know, we've talked about you know, getting that baseline, figuring out who you're going to target in the first wave to kind of get them on board, and then the various techniques that you can do, you know, get Apple professional development, hire a consultant, hire me, hire Bradley, go on a school visit, go to a conference, go to an Apple event, something like that, and then bring it all back home again and start to try and build that culture in your school. And I suppose the key thing I want to say is that it's got to be an ongoing thing. It can't just be a big bang one thing. One day, we've been trained, now let's just go and do it. You know, it's got to be constant. And there's reasonable amount of research that shows that the amount of teacher development that you do is directly related to the outcomes that you get in your classroom. And the more you do it, the better outcomes you get. So whether that's internal development or external development, and sometimes the internal stuff can often be the best stuff, it's really, really, really important that you do it as well.
Yeah, and again, I agree with what you said, that it's ongoing, because again, imagine if you did this 2 years ago, when this is, you know, every year Apple releases new APIs, apps change, what you can do changes, so you've got to keep going.
Yeah, I mean, imagine you trained people in Evernote for iOS in 2010.
No, yeah, it'd be a lot different.
They wouldn't even recognize the application today. You know, and I think that's another thing for technical people who are maybe listening. It's important to get your eye on those key points where technology changes and do a technical update there as well. Do the technical training you would have done at the first day. Do it again for new stuff. For example, when iOS 7 came out and then the new iWork 2.0 for iOS came out, and obviously Mavericks and the new iWork on the Mac as well, I did a big thing for all our staff there. I said, you know, okay, I trained you years ago on being iOS users, and that has served you pretty well for a few years, but the world just changed again. So now here's the things you need to know to get into this new world of Mavericks and iOS 7. And it wasn't a long session, but it hit the key points, in particular highlighting this thing about the file formats between iOS and Mac being compatible now, but possibly not compatible with older things that you may have on your computers from times past as well. It's a big topic, and it's one that's not going away. It's something that will be with you essentially always. And of course, as we haven't even talked about it, and I don't think we really want to take time to talk about it just now, but do bear in mind that as new staff come into your school, until we get to a world where every school's one-to-one on whatever platform, when staff move to your school, you're going to have to get them very quickly up to speed with a lot of things that you do, which will probably be quite at odds with the previous experience that they've had. And certainly their teacher training won't have prepared them for it at all up till now. I don't know if teacher training has kind of caught up with this yet. I'm not sure about that. But I think it's something to be aware of in your staff induction as well, is all this work that you've done with your existing staff, you're going to have to do it very quickly with new staff who come along as well. So do bear that in mind as you go along too.
Absolutely.
Okay. Shall we leave it there?
I think so.
Week 4 of 15.
I think so.
We're getting through it.
Yes, yes, it'll be over before you know it.
Just like years. Yeah, the older you get, the shorter the years seem. I stroke my gray beard as I sit here talking to you.
If the days are long, the years are short.
Isn't that the truth? Okay, let's leave it there, Bradley. Where can people find the show? Oh, we've got a new URL we should mention as well. We're putting together a page on the website, which is just these shows. There's no RSS feed for that page. It's just a place for people to come and read the content so that they know which show we talked about which thing, and it's quite detailed. It's outofschool.net/deploy2014 is the URL for just this series of shows. We're tweeting that URL and using that hashtag deploy2014 as well. So that's something that if you end up listening to a late show of this, that's where you can go to find all the early shows as well. So where can people find you on the web, Bradley?
I'm on the web at chambersdaily.com and at Bradley Chambers on Twitter. And, again, we're the Deploy 2014 page, I think, is going to be a lot of fun. I hope it's a great resource for you. It's not, the show notes aren't as detailed. Let's say the Technical Difficulties podcast, where they write, I think, 5,000 words per show. But we kind of think of it as a blog post per show, essentially.
Yeah, they're doing an ebook per show. We're doing a blog post per show.
That's a great, great way to put it. Great show, by the way. Technicaldifficulties .us, I believe, is the URL.
I've seen the show notes, but I've not listened to it. I haven't even listened to your episode, so I'm sorry about that.
It's okay. It's okay. You can do it tonight, and then we can talk about it next week. I'm kidding.
Okay. It's my homework. Okay, so I'm on the web at spears.org, S-P-E-I-R-S.org, and Fraser Spears on Twitter. And we'll talk to you next week for week 5.
Have a good week, everybody.